This is Voices in Exile. Voices in Exilio. Some of this was actually aired on the Pacifica Radio Network on a show called Informed Dissent. Since only 5-minute excerpts from only a few of the speakers were used on the show, here you can listen to all the responses in full.
My name is Jessica Walker. I'm the Managing Director of Young Voter Strategies. Young Voter Strategies' mission is to engage young people in the political process and to try to encourage politicians and people involved in the political system to take young people's issues seriously. Turnout among 18 to 29-year-old voters increased by more than 2 million in the 2006 elections compared to 2002. We saw a 4 percentage point youth turnout increase, and that's in comparison to less than a 1 percent point increase amongst all adults. People that are young voters tend to be similar to the general population in a lot of ways. We saw this election as a statement to bring about change, and we saw young people saying that the majority of young people that we polled and that we got anecdotal information from were saying that they were looking for a change. They were looking for politicians to address issues important to them. Top up on the list was Iraq and also college affordability. About 41.9 million young people age 18 to 29 are eligible to vote this past election day, and that's compared to 158.2 million people 30 or older. So the youth vote accounts for about 21% of the electorate. I think that young people definitely are engaged in civic participation much more so. We see higher rates of Peace Corps volunteerism, AmeriCorps, Teach for America. So we see young people paying attention to politics more and a willingness to be engaged. Also, young people not happy about the way that the country is being run right now and looking for politicians to address issues that are important to them. Generally, people turn out to vote in higher rates when they're not happy with the way things are going. So we see that as a general trend in the country, and young people are not that different from older voters. But we also ran a huge campaign along with 15 different partners. Organizations. We worked with groups like Public Interest Research Group, the New Voters Project, who were targeting college campuses primarily and using grassroots, traditional, face-to-face interaction with students. We worked with groups who are specifically targeting demographic populations, such as Women's Voices, Women's Vote, looking at young women, Black Youth Vote, who is looking towards young Black students, and looking at different Brimstone Services and We Care America, looking at the evangelical population and the religious population targeting youth in churches and Christian rock shows in terms of reaching out to young voters. And we're seeing politicians also increasingly reaching out to young voters. We saw lots of politicians actually visiting college campuses and talking about college affordability. And we saw different organizations going out and talking to young people and engaging them. Our research shows and the feedback that we've gotten is that if you ask young people to vote, they will. They just need to be addressed and engaged in the political system. It's definitely not a fluke. Young people are increasingly engaged, and we expect them to be jumping even higher numbers in 2008.
For change, the system is not working.
Here we spoke with Natasha Marsh from the San Francisco chapter of the League of Young Voters.
My name is Natasha Marsh, and I grew up in Oakland, and I am the California director for the League of Young Voters, also known as the League of Pissed Off Voters. And what we've been doing around the country is engaging young people who have been shut out of the political process, young people who are the most unlikely voters, young people of color, low-income young people, immigrant young people, and supporting them to use voting and to use political engagement as a way to build power and solve problems in our communities. So the League of Young Voters, we have permanent field operations in California, New Mexico, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Pennsylvania and Maine. And then we also have affiliates in Minnesota and Florida and a couple other states. One of the things the League has done on the national level is made voter guides all around the country. Voter guides made by young people for young people, both nonpartisan and PAC voter guides that actually say, this is who we think you should vote for as this is the candidate who is going to stand for social justice, who's going to stand for more money for higher education, who's going to stand for immigrants' rights, so that no one on election day was like, I don't know what to vote for, I'm not going to vote. And we have used innovative methods of registering and turning out young voters and also engaging young people to be holding their elected officials accountable The core of our methods is peer-to-peer organizing, and we only hire staff who are from the communities that they're working in. And we really believe that our job is to make politics relevant and to make voting relevant. And that's why young people are not voting. It's not because we don't care about our communities. Young people deeply care about our communities. And it's about making those connections and making sure that young people have the information they need, because no one talks to young people about politics. No one talks to young people about elections. We don't get voter registration cards in the mail when we turn 18. And we're trying to make sure that young people in the places they're already at, in high schools, at clubs, at parties, in the streets, wherever they are having the chance to register to vote and get information. This year, what we did to get young voters out to the polls in California, and this is similar to what we did around the country, we had our voter guides. We sent text messages on election day saying, you know, happy election day, don't forget to get out and vote, and had a link in those text messages to our online voter guides. We actually did robocalls for the first time, and I think we're probably the first young voter organization ever to do that. So we had our young organizers making robocalls that went out to young voters the night before election day. And then we did tons of visibility with voter guides, with chalking on Laney College campus, chalking on San Francisco State. At CSUs all around the state. In San Francisco, you know, where I was, we had this bar crawl, essentially, where we had 80 people going to 7 different bars one Saturday night and distributing 3,000 voter guides the Saturday before Election Day. And we also did a lot of looking up polling places for students on campuses and in our GOTV emails, or Get Out the Vote emails. Because the two main obstacles to young people voting are, one, not having information about what to vote for, especially in California where there's so many propositions which are so confusing, and then also people literally not knowing how to vote, not knowing where to go vote, not knowing when the hours of polling places are open and stuff. In Ohio, in Columbus, tens of thousands of voters, particularly voters around the University of Ohio campus, so we're talking young voters, were forced to vote with provisional ballots. And there's more information on that at www.indievoter.org. And that is a still contested congressional election that's going to depend on these 20,000 provisional ballots that were cast primarily by young people at this university campus. And just the other thing is that in Ohio, I think it's really important to note that young voters turned out in record numbers and did not only organize themselves as voters, but also are organizing themselves to make sure that their votes get counted and that their votes, their right to vote, doesn't get taken away.
Do you have any idea on which elections the League of Young Voters, the League of Pissed Off Voters, may have swung with your voter guides?
As far as election, we know that we swung elections in Maine. We got two young people in Maine under 30 elected to the city council in a city council that previously had had no one, I think, under the age of 50. So there are now two 128 and 129-year-old, and we know that we swung that also in Maine. Tabor, the supposed taxpayer bill of rights, the league ran essentially the bulk of the no one Tabor campaign, which was defeated in spite of a whole lot of money being put into trying to get it passed. We're clear that we swung both of those elections in Maine.
Okay, and is there anything else you'd like to tell us, and if people want to help, how they can?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple things that just, it's the job of everybody who wants elected officials, who wants government that is going to be accountable to and is going to advance social justice agendas. And in order for that to happen, it's all of our responsibility to make sure politics are relevant to young people and to people of color and all the people who are not voting at the same rate as essentially older, wealthier white people. And if we want progressives to be elected, we need to make sure that elected officials and campaigns are talking about higher education affordability, talking about the war, talking about the draft, talking about making voting more accessible for young people. Otherwise, young people, you know, are going to be turned off by the Democratic Party. They're going to be turned off by the system altogether. And we need that not to happen.
No.
Okay. So also, if you want to get involved, go to indievoter.org, IndyVoter.org, and sign up to get involved.
to say about the hip-hop and the vote?
I'm so excited in terms of young people in the hip-hop generation about the appearance of folks like the League of Young Voters, the League of Pissed Off Voters, and here in the Bay Area, the Amy Allison campaign. And it's been really exciting to see young people of color and young activists really starting to think about voting as one strategic way to make our voices heard. Whereas I think 10 years ago, voting was not considered a radical act.
25,000 people marching towards Oakland City Hall with their fists in the air and a sense of urgency in their chants.
This is Maya in Berkeley, speaking with Davy D from Hard Knock Radio on KPFA. How are you doing, Davy?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for joining us at this election special for the National Pacifica audience. We wanted to focus on the hip-hop influence or role in the elections. Last election in 2004, many media outlets threw off much of hip-hop's outreach to young voters as a joke, completely ignoring the fact that record numbers of young Black and Latino voters hit the polls. Based on what I'm seeing through groups like the League of Pissed Off Voters, Young Voters, last 2006 midterm elections once again had a record turnout. And this time around, we heard almost nothing about all the young vote on the mainstream news. Do you know why?
Well, first thing we have to kind of keep in mind is, interestingly enough, some of the first people to dismiss the hip-hop vote, so to speak, were actually the Democrats, or people who would be Democratic-leaning, which I found to be very interesting considering there was a pretty strong likelihood that younger people and people in the hip-hop community would go towards that particular party. And I think it was a way to kind of deflect the type of potential power struggle that will eventually arise. First of all, when you keep using the word young people, as they often do, you start to think of somebody who's in high school and not somebody who's an adult and who has a job and pays taxes and should be at any sort of table where decisions are made. So when you look at it, as you pointed out, in 2004, the only group of people, 18 to 34, that was the only group of people to vote overwhelmingly for John Kerry. And all the other demographics fell short. So when you look at Russell Simmons, when you look at P. Diddy, you look at the National Hip Hop Political Convention, you would see that the politics that they were about were pretty much most likely to be found within the Democratic Party's platform. So that was just kind of interesting and something that people should take note of when they think about this and have this discussion. I didn't really see it as immediately dismissed on the Republican side. The second thing is, in the last election, as you pointed out, there were a lot of efforts that came forth that were totally overlooked. The most notable is the League of Pissed Off Voters and the voter guides that they gave out in close to 100 cities, each of them detailing some of the key races around measures, propositions, as well as recommendations for some of the local races where you might have a mayor or somebody on city council. Like in San Francisco, they advocated that you vote for Chris Daley. In Oakland, they advocated that you look out for Amy Allison. So those types of efforts were put forth, and that totally went underneath the radar. And it also smacks of a contradiction when you consider that a lot of people are quick to say, well, you know, that group of people are totally apolitical. The other thing was that I think that a lot of the conversation when you talk about the anti-war effort was definitely generated on the younger side of the, or at least in the hip-hop enclave. When you look at all the rap albums, compilation albums, all the rap songs, close to 100 anti-war songs came out. No, you don't hear them on MTV. No, you don't see them on BET. But if you, a lot of the fans of those artists were quite aware of that type of music and the type of efforts that were put forth. And, I mean, there's some pretty glaring omissions, but examples that impacted people, most notably the one that came out of the West Coast, where you had all the gangster rappers, so-called gangster rappers, teaming up with other artists in Los Angeles to do not one, but two anti-war songs, with everybody from Cypress Hill to Mobb Deep to KRS-One all participating, and it was produced by Snoop's producer, Fred Wreck. And that was a pretty popular record that went underneath the radar. And people might not want to give it credit, but it definitely was one of the many galvanizing forces, or the We the People Festival that took place in Los Angeles last year that brought out thousands of people, you know, again organized by folks in the hip-hop community, and, you know, had a very strong anti-war message. So to the degree that the anti-war sentiment was a reason for the Republicans being defeated, you definitely cannot ignore the efforts that hip-hop had in definitely keeping that conversation alive and at least exciting a lot of people within its space.
Thank you, David D. from Hard Knock Radio. You mentioned a couple of groups that I wanted to ask you about. Do you think that the mainstream groups targeting youth and young people of color, like you said, because part of it, I think, with the hip hop, is it the people that know all those songs and stuff that you laid out? Do you think that, number one, do you think that they're aware of the issues, the initiatives on the ballot and the candidates?
Well, it depends. I think just the process alone is very confusing. So it's not just that group. I think a lot of people, if you ask them about particular propositions outside their immediate interest, would be hard-pressed to, you know, lay it out exactly what it meant and didn't mean. But with that being said, you know, when you have songs and groups or efforts being put forth by high-profile people, what it does allow is for follow-up conversation. And I think to a certain degree, you're starting to see that more and more. And definitely you had some of that follow-up conversation when you had those voter guides that were given out. So that's how I kind of see it. You know, with respect to particular songs, again, you know, songs are a tool. They're not going to be the be-all, end-all. And I think some people who are kind of removed from the process just figure, well, it's Public Enemy or Paris or Dead Prez does a song. That's all that's needed. All those things do is just kind of perk people's attention, and then everybody else has to kind of follow up and then try to, you know, let people see some of the depth behind those particular propositions or candidates.
What, if any, was hip-hop's role in this last election, and what do you think hip-hop's role will be in the future? Future elections?
Well, you know, let me answer the last question first. I think within the next 4 or 5 years, you're going to see people running for office. And primarily because one of the interesting things to note is that all across the board, people are not satisfied with the two parties. At least the people that I come across, they're definitely not satisfied with the Republican, and they're not satisfied with the Democratic Party for way too many reasons to name off. Primarily because too many people took a pro-war stance as opposed to an anti-war stance. People are kind of skittish about trying to really fully embrace and engage, you know, that constituency, aside from a few like a Maxine Waters or a Barbara Lee and maybe a few others. But there hasn't really been an across-the-board concerted effort to really try and engage people in a way where they not only feel a sense of ownership, but also can see how they share in the power. So I think you're going to see people starting to run on their own, where people aren't trying to compromise and make all types of concessions, but they can just wholeheartedly get behind a candidate. And I think I'm starting to see people position themselves where they're either learning the process or getting themselves groomed. So that's something that I think will happen in upcoming elections. As far as this one is concerned, aside from some of the issues, at least around the anti-war efforts that were raised, I think, you know, people were definitely, I saw people more involved on local levels than I did see on a national scope. People would, you know, had it not been for the hip-hop generation, Chris Daley wouldn't have gotten back in to office. Unfortunately, Amy Allison didn't win, but there was definitely hip-hoppers in her corner. In New York and in other places, you could find local elections where there was a strong presence. Charles Barron, he lost by 3,000 votes, and he aggressively went after the hip-hop community and getting people from Immortal Technique on down to Dead Prez involved in his campaign. He only lost by 3,000. So 3,000 votes for his bid for Congress. So when you look to find out where hip-hop is, you have to look at it on a very local level as opposed to the national picture. I think one of the things that folks need to kind of look out for is two things. One is avoid just seeing what is presented in the mainstream without
looking at it in the context. I mean, one of the things that happened in 2004 was we only focused on P. Diddy and Russell, and we totally overlooked a lot of the quote-unquote grassroots efforts, which I think wind up being the sustaining force all the way up to 2006 and will continue to be in 2008 and beyond. Meaning that, you know, as much as I like Russell and as much as I like P. Diddy, they didn't put out voter guides. You know, they weren't out there doing the voter education the way that some of the more grassroots and people who you don't see on the mainstream every day were doing. And that's where the difference was being, that's where the difference was made and will continue to be made. And I guess the other thing is that folks will have to have a willingness to share power with those who are coming up and stop looking at folks as people who are to be overlooked or discarded or not taken seriously because they think of young people as somebody who's still in high school. When you talk about young people, you talk about hip-hop, you're talking about people going all the way up to 40 and below. And so I think that's going to be something that you're going to have to pay close attention to. And if not, there's going to be a rude awakening for a lot of folks. When they sit up there and go, well, how did this happen or why did this happen? It will be because there hasn't been a willingness to really sit down and fully engage that particular demographic of people the way that they would if they were talking about seniors or particular ethnic groups that they feel need to be courted. That hip-hop audience definitely needs to be courted, and woe unto those who don't.
So do you want to give any advice or any, what do you think will happen to the party that does use hip-hop?
I think you're going to find some very interesting alliances. It didn't pan out to the degree that maybe people had hoped for, but I thought it was pretty interesting that you saw hip-hop support for Michael Steele, who was a Republican when he ran in Maryland. You know, I thought, you know, Russell Simmons aggressively campaigned for him. Because he was dissatisfied with, you know, the type of stances that were taken by the person who did win for governor. Cousin Jeff, who's pretty popular on BT, got behind a Republican candidate in Ohio. You know, I didn't agree with the move, but the fact is, when you talk to those people, even though they didn't work in unison with each other, it was always the same, that they're not satisfied with the direction that the Democrats are, or the stances that many of the Democrats have taken. So I think you'll find in particular, even when you look at the voter guides for the League of Pissed Off Voters, they were not across the board for Democrats. I mean, some places they were for Green Party, other places they were for some places they were for Democrats, other places they were for the GOP. So I think what's happening is people are starting to look and see where candidates stand on particular issues, and then kind of rally or show their support or not show their support, as opposed to just automatically lining up behind the Democratic machinery and just calling it a day. I think those days are over, and that's something that people need to be aware of.
Okay, well, thank you so much for covering so much with us. And, you know, I look for finding you on the ballot for presidential election.
Yeah, I'm running in 2038.
That's what I'm running. 38.
238. Look for David D. running for president.
Okay, well, you know, we got your back.
Thank you very much.
All right, you take care.
Peace.
I'm speaking to Mos Def. Do you think hip-hop may have affected the result of this last election?
Somewhat
mainstream.
I mean, I can't say no, and I wouldn't be surprised if it did. I mean, it's definitely a cultural force, an economic force. Mm-hmm. So I can't see any direct ways, but I wouldn't be surprised. But I can't think of any ways of him right now. I don't see much difference between Democrat and Republican nowadays anyway. I think there's just a changing tide in the world in general.
And we got Mizzle in the house from the Yellow Bus back in the building. What's up, Mizzle? Came to tell him what's up. Man. What is hip-hop's influence on politics right now?
Tell you the truth, I think it go both ways, because they gonna really wipe it out to where nobody is gonna be able to get their message across. You know, they can filter and try to decipher what's not coming out of a big record company. Stewie, Stewie,
Stewie. Next, I spoke with Sheldon Rampton of the Center of Media and Democracy.
My name is Sheldon Rampton. I'm the research director at the Center for Media and Democracy. We are an organization that specializes in studying deceptive marketing, propaganda, and public relations. We're a watchdog organization.
Okay. There are a variety of first-person shooters, such as Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon, the Navy SEAL's SOCOM series, and the U.S. Army's electronic recruitment tool, America's Army Overmatch, which has a link to the Army's website built right into the game. Could you touch upon the gaming industry, and more specifically, what some call the military-industrial entertainment complex?
The relationship between the military and the entertainment industry goes back actually for decades. You can find deliberate, planned collaborations between the Hollywood and the military going back to the Second World War, for example. But the use of video games as a marketing tool is a fairly new development. Of course, a lot of video games are what they call shooter games, which consist of, games in which people basically practice shooting targets, mostly people or humanoid figures, that could not fail to become a topic of interest to the military. So they actually went to Ubisoft, the same company that develops all of the Tom Clancy video games, and had them develop America's Army specifically as a recruiting tool. And the game is set up so that you can play online, you join a network, you're encouraged to share information and to contact recruiters. It's literally an on-ramp from playing at shooting people to actually shooting people.
Ubisoft has a group of young women they call frag dolls. I actually read on your article, War is Fun as Hell, how basically America's Army, and specifically the U.S. Army, used frag dolls sort of to promote their game. Could you speak about that?
One of the ways that video games are promoted and end up reaching the attention of end consumers is at gaming conferences. And what happens there is that gamers show up, they get to practice the various games. And a very common practice at gaming conferences is the use of what are often referred to as booth babes, which are, attractive young women who pose decoratively near the games as a way of attracting the young guys. Well, Ubisoft has its own booth babes who actually play the games themselves, who go by the name the Frag Dolls. This is a real-world group of attractive young women gamers who go by names such as Eakers and Valkyrie and Jinx, and they're paid to promote the products. So, for example, last year at a computer gaming conference, they were sent out as booth babes at the America's Army demo, where they played the game and posed for photos and video, and encouraged guys to come up and play the game with them. And it's an interesting thing because on the America's Army websites, are sponsored by the U.S. military itself, they have video clips of people trying out the games and talking about it. And the reaction to these guys, they come up is two things. One, they say that they really like playing with the frag dolls, they're babes, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing is they like playing the game because to them it feels more realistic because the actual weapons they use in shooting in the America's Army booth have the same heft as real rifles and things. So they actually have the notion conveyed to them through this all of this. They're actually experiencing something close to combat. But of course, real combat doesn't involve shooting at make-believe targets while, attractive young girls stand by your side and comment on your technique. One of the insidious things about all these war games is that they create a very sanitized vision of war in people's eyes. I mean, in real war, things happen like watching your buddies get injured or die in your arms, or having to make difficult choices about shooting someone because you think they may be trying to kill you, and so forth, and guilt and, dirt and gore are part of the real world experience. But in the gaming experience, it's like shooting ducks in a gallery. It's a technical exercise. You score points rather than deal with grief and fear and real pain. The result of staging war as a video game is a subtle form of propaganda that, anyone rationally, of course, can understand the point I'm making. But nevertheless, at the level of feelings and emotions, people do end up, through playing these games, coming away with the feeling, and they'll say it, that that's what they think war is like.
Now, is there any other ways the military has been using various forms of media at this current time to increase the interest of military in youth?
Well, I think that two things are coming together. One is that the games have become very popular because they're sort of easy to play and easy to get hooked on. And so they've become commercially successful in their own right, but they've also become very appealing to the military as a means of marketing their particular product, which is join the army and you'll get to do this as your job. And what you find happening, and you see this, for example, in a number of memoirs that soldiers have written of their actual experiences in Iraq, is that soldiers go over there with this very gung-ho attitude that we're just going to go over there and we're going to kick butt, we're going to zap people, we're going to, you know, it all seems like this sort of comic book language about what they're going to be doing over there. And they end up going to war on the basis of this very artificial set of assumptions about what the experience is going to be like. Some of the flavor of it is actually captured in the overview that America's Army Overmatch says. They have a voiceover as you start up the game that says that the game will be a contest in which one opponent is distinctly superior with specialized skills and superior technology. Overmatch, few soldiers, certain victory. That language actually is very, very similar to the message that helped lead us into Iraq. Our technology is superior. We will prevail easily. Few soldiers, certain victory. It's almost exactly what people like Donald Rumsfeld were saying about the actual war in Iraq. The other thing about all of this, is that I think it has a tendency to desensitize people to the fact that what they're really rehearsing when they play these games and then act them out in real life, what they're really rehearsing is killing. Mm-hmm. And it's an actual lesson through doing in the art of dehumanizing your opponent, turning your opponent into literally a machine or nothing more than a target, and then shooting it as a technical exercise. The fact that the insidious nature of this is reflected, among other things, in the fact that the U.S. Army is not the only player that has started to use video games as recruiting tools. Recently, the terrorists came out with their own video game, and they called it the Night of Bush Capturing. And in the game, you get to play shooting at U.S. soldiers. And the final target is that you get to kill George W. Bush. The interesting thing about that is that the game, which they called Night of Bush Capturing, is actually modeled after, it's actually a clone with very slight modifications of a game that was previously called The Quest for Saddam, that was marketed by a supporter of the war with Iraq as a way of letting people play the game of hunting for Saddam Hussein, and all they had to do to turn it into Night of Bush Capturing was stick in a few different graphics and some Arabic music. I would just hope that people would think about I think there is a tendency for people to think, well, this is just harmless play, these games, but what's really going on in these games is a form of propaganda and indoctrination, and it is actual rehearsing of violence, and it does lead people to become desensitized to real violence and to become involved in violent activities, including war, without thinking about the real consequences of those activities.
Okay. If you want to bring in maybe more uses of mainstream media and pop culture the military is currently using.
The military is obviously targeting youth for recruitment because they're the generation that are of age to be recruited, and the recruitment starts in high school. There are extensive plans and guidebooks for high school recruiters that encourage Army representatives to become so much a part of the school scene that they're in constant contact with coaches and librarians, administrative staff, teachers. They're supposed to distribute desk calendars to schools, attend athletic events, get involved with the PTA. And in fact, the Pentagon's recruitment strategy for schools is so good that the public relations industry has looked at it and said that it's a model that people ought to look at anytime they want to figure out how to do marketing in schools. It's that thorough and that well designed. And on top of that, of course, there's constant advertising and one of the things that I find rather interesting about that is that the advertisements, which are mostly targeted at parents, mm-hmm. send a somewhat different message than the video games. The video games send this message that, you know, war is fun as hell. You know, you're going to go over there and you're going to blast away and it's just going to be just like playing your video games. The message on television that you see is that the kid's gonna, is that joining the army is like a finishing school. The kid's gonna grow up, and you know, there's one that they had recently where someone joins the army and he shakes his dad's hand, and his dad says, "That's the first time you've looked me in the eye like that when you shook my hand," and so on the one hand, the kids are being told that war is a way to continue your youth by continuing to play games, but the message to their parents is send your kids into the army and they will learn discipline and maturity and grow up.
Finally, I spoke with Josh Sonnenfeld, a counter-recruitment organizer who used to work with Leave My Child Alone and now works on campus at UCSC.
Well, these days I work for Group College Students Against War at UC Santa Cruz. I work with a bunch of different organizations, like the Leave My Child Alone Coalition and the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz, California. I started doing kind of recruitment work back when I was a high school student. It was back in 2003, right before the war was getting started. There's a bill called the No Child Left Behind Act that was passed. So I started working with a bunch of high school students to address the way in which military recruiters are getting unparalleled access to high school students. That was a lot of concern for us.
Could you define what counter-recruitment is?
Well, I think people have different definitions for counter-recruitment. You know, counter-recruitment's been a movement that's been going on for a long time, before this war even started, since the Vietnam War days and before then. There's been people that have been working in counter-recruitment all over the 90s, where they basically see that what we have is frequently called a poverty draft, where military would go into low-income communities. And because there's not a lot of options for a lot of youth, especially working-class youth and youth of color, they're effectively being drafted in the military at very disproportionate rates. So there have been a lot of people specifically working on counter-recruitment work, like trying to provide options for youth so they can go to college, they can get jobs, without having to use the military as some sort of jobs program, which it isn't. So that's one history of counter-recruitment. But since the war started, counter-recruitment has another facet. That aspect of counter-recruitment is the knowledge that if we're really interested in stopping the war, then if the military doesn't have the troops to fight it, then the war is going to have to end. Part of what counter-military recruitment work does is we just try to provide the real statistics for folks to see what it really means to join the military. So, for example, the military might say, "Hey, man, you can get $50,000 for college. You know, we'll pay your tuition. We'll give you money for books." And a lot of people buy into that. But what they don't tell you is that more than 56% of the people that join the military don't get a single dime for college. Because you have to meet all these specific requirements. Like, maybe if you're a nuclear engineer, you can make like $40,000 for college or something like that. But most people aren't going to be a nuclear engineer in the military. Most people, when they join the military, they're going to be doing stuff like supply line, like front line, you know, people who are fighting the war. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't believe in war, and I don't believe that it should be the most oppressed people in our society that should have to fight it. Well, the funny thing is that the No Child Left Behind Act provision on military recruitment, Section 9508, it's not anything new these days. We're approaching the fifth anniversary since this bill was passed, and there's been a lot of us that have been working on it ever since it was passed. Basically, what happened was the Pentagon was struggling to recruit people before 9/11 even happened because folks were getting greater access to college. There was a lot more opportunities to do job training, and the economy was doing good. A lot of people weren't joining the military. So the Pentagon was really struggling to get people into the military, and so they got their congressional allies to sneak this little section into the No Child Left Behind Act, which was effectively an education bill. But what they did was they snuck in this part about military recruitment. And military recruitment doesn't have anything to do with education. I'd say it's actually the opposite, where you're sending kids to go off and fight wars rather than being where they should be in college and institutes of higher education. Basically, what it does is it forces high schools to give student contact information to local military recruiters. Just the way that it works, there's an opt-out provision, meaning that you can prevent your child's information from being sent out, or students, including students under 18, can prevent their own information from being sent to the military. But the way the bureaucracy of schools work and school districts work means that parents won't know about their right to opt a child out, and most students won't know about the fact that their information is being sent to the military. It's one of these unfunded mandates that most people don't know about. And so effectively what we have is millions of students' contact information being sent over to the military for recruitment purposes without them ever even knowing about it. Well, usually if a parent wants to opt out, all they have to do is, you know, sign an opt-out form, which school districts are required to give. They're required to tell parents how they can opt out. And there's a database called Jammers, J-A-M-R-S, and so we have two databases. Your local school district has a database that has student contact information, and then the Pentagon is building this database of student contact information as well that they're getting from sources like the ASVAB test, which is the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. And it's this test that a lot of school districts, especially school districts in low-income areas, give the students some sort of aptitude test. But rather than, you know, like a career test, rather than giving them real career options, like telling them to be doctors or professors or anything along those lines, what effectively the ASVAB test does is provide military recruiters with the contact information of students and the type of military job that they would be most suited for. So rather than getting answers like professor, doctor, fireman, you get answers like artillery, Air Force, pilot, you know, you get answers like cook in the military, stuff like that. So it's this test that the Army gives to school districts for free, you know, acting as if they're some sort of, you know, benevolent father figure. But in reality, they're just using it for military recruitment purposes. And usually when students take this test, their information is given to the military, which they don't know about. The test isn't required. It's not mandatory, but a lot of school districts will tell students that it is. So ASVAB is just another one of those problematic things that happens in our schools that gives the military easier access to our kids.
I'd like to sort of talk about what the backdoor draft is.
Well, the backdoor draft is frequently called the poverty draft. But there's kind of like two drafts that are going on right now. One of those drafts is the poverty draft that I already mentioned, yeah. Where, you know, kids that are living in areas that are have very high rates of poverty feel like they don't have any options, so they want to join the military, yeah. Because they believe in all the military's lies about money for college and job training. And so for most people, they come back out of the military, you know, it's an eight-year gig. They join in, they come back, and they see that their friends have already been through college, and maybe even another college after that. Mm-hmm. Maybe they already have jobs, and here they are. They're out of the military, and, you know, what are their best options? Working at McDonald's, working at Burger King. So a lot of people have been coming out, a lot of veterans have been coming out and speaking out and saying, you know, these promises that the military has been giving us are just a bunch of lies. As I mentioned, the first part is the poverty draft, but the second is what's frequently called stop loss. Stop loss means that you can be in the military for your whole 8-year service, because that's what you're required by your enlistment agreement to serve is 8 years. It could be like 4 years active duty, 4 years reserve. But as we know, a lot of reservists have been fighting wars these days. Stop loss is this law that basically says that you can serve your full 8 years in the military, and the military can snatch you right back up again without you ever having to sign a contract and force you to go and fight in places like Iraq or Afghanistan. So what we have here is we have people who have already given their 8 years being sent off to fight again. That's why we see folks that are doing 2, maybe 3 tours to Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, and every time you go there is another risk of getting yourself killed, another risk of getting post-traumatic stress disorder, another risk of getting some sort of medical ailment. Every soldier that's died in Iraq, there's at least 2 soldiers that have been severely wounded, you know, without arms, legs, eyes, ears.
How has the military recently changed their tactics over the last year or two to increase the amount of new recruits applying for the armed services?
Well, one of the things that the military has done is the military and the Bush administration has actually provided some sort of citizenship benefits for people who aren't citizens of the United States but join the military. So I think there's at least 20,000 people who are in the military right now, a significant portion of the military, that aren't U.S. citizens. Maybe they have green cards, or maybe they're promised that they can get citizenship. So that's been one of the tactics that they've used in order to get more people into the military. But a lot of these folks are citizens of other countries. So you have citizens of Mexico, El Salvador, fighting the U.S. military. And these folks aren't doing it necessarily because they believe in the wars that are currently going on in Iraq, Afghanistan, and everywhere else, but just because they're looking for a way to provide for their families, and they want to prove to the country that they're just as American as anyone else. And so they're kind of working off this want of immigrant communities to be able to prove themselves. And they're using all kinds of misleading information, saying, hey, you know, we'll get citizenship for you and your family, which a lot of time hasn't turned out to be the case. That's one of the tactics that they've been using. They've also been really working hard lately on recruiting more Latino families. You know, they have the Los OAL Army campaign. But they're still struggling, you know, like they've been really focused on re-enlisting people who are already in the military and trying to get every single National Guard they can to go tour in Iraq or Afghanistan. I think we recently heard that folks in the National Guard are going to have to do a second tour in Iraq, which is really tough because the National Guard, this isn't what they're for.
Yeah,
the National Guard is supposed to respond to natural disasters such as Katrina, which obviously didn't really happen. So you have to ask the questions, you know, if our National Guard is being used to fight wars because the military isn't getting enough people to join, then what's happening here at home and are we really safe? So they're struggling, you know, they realize that people aren't wanting to join. They're doing every single thing that they can do to try to get people to join the military. And, you know, they have these huge advertising budgets. They're spending like billions and billions of dollars just on trying to convince our youth that they should be joining the military. And, you know, more and more, the youth of this country have been saying, like, no, we aren't going to buy into your lies. We aren't going to buy into what you're saying. And we don't want to go and fight in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's kind of sad because this is our tax money that's going into this. When our schools need money and our communities need money in order to give some real options to our youth, where is that money going? It's going to military recruitment. And if not enough people want to join the military because they don't believe in what the military is doing, what does that say about what this country is doing right now? You can't get people to fight a war. Do you think we really should be in that war? I hope they know.
Do you see any new ways the military is using the media to their advantage?
Oh, yeah. It's actually pretty scary. I might have, sorry if I interrupted you, but the Pentagon recently announced that they're starting up an even more intensive kind of like propaganda unit. Mm-hmm. So what, if you watch CNN and if you watch, and if you just read the articles that you see in the news, a lot of times the articles, at the end of every sentence, will be a comma and it says, Army sources say, or military sources say, or the Bush administration says. So what becomes news isn't actually people who are working with the media that are in Iraq or Afghanistan, but just people who are basically just quoting press releases from the military. You know, the military has their own photographers, the military has their own reporters. The military effectively is writing the story that we're reading in the newspapers every day. Even though the stories may be in the Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, they're still written by the military, and they still have photos from the military.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very scary because, you know, how are we supposed to analyze what's going on in the war and really know what's going on when all of our news is coming from the U.S. military, which has a very specific purpose? So, you know, and even the actual media themselves have been embedded reporters, as a lot of people have mentioned in the past. So they're, you know, they aren't going and talking to Iraqis. Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with the statistic that majority of the people that are in this country right now are opposed to the war. That's an amazing statement because it's true. You know, majority of people in this country are opposed to the war. So what does that mean? That means that in order to stop this war, we have to find effective ways in which to incapacitate the military from being able to wage it. And kind of recruitment is one of these prime areas. Now, I think a lot of people got really depressed right after the war started, and that's the reason protesting for so long, and now they're just not really sure what to do. What I have to say to that is that people need to find very strategic, very very goal-oriented campaigns to work on. So, for example, if you see kids in your community are joining the military, then why don't you start tabling at the high schools? Get together with some of your friends and give them some of those alternatives. You know, talk to them about how they can get to college, how they can get financial aid. Give them those statistics about things like job training and money for college and kind of proving that the military is full of hot air with those sort of things. But it's also about taking more more direct actions too. Mm-hmm. You know, not just standing on the corners with our peace flags, but going up to those military recruitment centers and maybe shutting them down for a day and see what happens. You know, I think there's been a lot of youth around this country that have been doing those sort of actions, and if the rest of us that are in this country got behind them, we'd see some significant changes happening. You know, and for the people that have already joined in the military, the people that have already joined the military, they're not stupid. They know what they're doing there, what they're not doing there, and they just need our support so that they can get out. So there's groups like the GI Rights Hotline that do really great work. So you can go to their website, which is grights.org, and you can learn how to be a counselor, you know, learn how to counsel people who are in the military to help them get out, to provide them with medical services and stuff like that. Because right now we have something like 40,000 people who are AWOL in the military. 40,000 people. So these are 40,000 soldiers who, you know, for whatever reason, don't want to be sent off to Iraq, don't want to fight again. Maybe they've already been in Iraq one or two times. So we're seeing an uprising in the military to a certain degree of troops who don't want to fight in the war. And we have to do everything we can to support them. And I think they know to a certain degree that we're here to support them. This whole thing about protesters spitting on the military isn't true. It's a lie that got crafted by the right-wing propagandists in order to try to disconnect the troops from the community. But, you know, there's a lot of soldiers that have been speaking out and organizing, groups like the Iraq Veterans Against the War, that are really inspiring. You know, go to their website. Look at how many soldiers are listed in their membership. You know, these guys are doing amazing work, and what they really need is our support. And what they really need is for us to step up and do our own strategic campaigns, too. You know, I think there's a value in having big demonstrations like the type that ANSA organizes. But really, if we're really interested in ending this war and providing more options for our youth, we have to think more about a long-haul strategy and about daily activities that we can do. So, you know, educating our youth and providing them with options, you know, because these are smart kids. They know mm-hmm. what they want to do. They just need help getting there, and we can help them with that. You know, just taking very strategic actions that can get us the end that we're trying to reach.
2 days after the elections, I spoke with Eric East, representing the Arizona Advocacy Network, a group which had taken a public stand against Proposition 103 in Arizona. This proposition, declaring English as Arizona's official language, was more symbolic than the other three propositions, which all passed in Arizona by surprisingly large margins, at all targeting immigrant communities of their state. Aside from Proposition 103, the propositions also included Proposition 102, which denies civil lawsuit awards for undocumented immigrants. Proposition 300, which denies undocumented immigrants in-state tuition, state-funded adult education, and state-assisted child care. And Proposition 100, which denies bail to undocumented immigrants who have committed felonies of a class 1, 2, 3, or 4, have committed a capital offense, or were already out on bail and previously charged of a felony. Before touching upon the ramifications of three of these four propositions, Eric began by briefly speaking on the history of Arizona's English-only mentality.
Back in, I believe it was 1988, in Arizona, we passed a proposition which declared English the official language. And it was called English only because it not only made English the official language, but it said that all government actions had to be performed in English, that all government employees had to basically speak nothing but English while they were at work and in the performance of their duties. And it went so far that it was declared unconstitutional by a federal court and thrown out.
Eric then spoke about the more recently passed Proposition 103.
Proposition 103 is an attempt to replace that section of the state constitution with something that would be deemed constitutional. Because of that, in many ways, it's largely symbolic. It does not have the same implications as the old English-only language that was in the Constitution. It does not mean that government employees have to speak only English when they're talking to people that they're dealing with. It does not mean that government cannot produce written materials that are in languages other than English. And it includes a whole range of exceptions that allow government use of other languages for specific purposes that weren't included in the old language. It's unclear what the actual ramifications are going to be. The government can still produce materials in Spanish or in other languages for educational purposes. They can translate for people who need translations. Educational exceptions, teaching of languages other than English, anything that's accepted or required under federal law, which would include things like our voting materials that are required to be in Spanish under the Voting Rights Act, anything to do with tourism or international trade, anything to do with public health and safety, including law enforcement and emergency, rights of victims of crime, specifically exempts using Native American languages. This does not mean that all of Arizona's government is suddenly going to become English only, you know, only speaking in English, only dealing with people in English. So anything that any kind of contract or binding document, any, quote, official document, has to be in English. Now, mm-hmm. they can translate it into other languages, but the translations are not official. It's only the English version okay. that is official and binding. Mm-hmm. It does have some problematic parts to it. It contains a clause that says that government representatives, anybody working for the government, basically, shall, quote, preserve, protect, and enhance the role of English as the official language of the government of Arizona. Hmm. Nobody knows what that means. The people who voted for it don't know what that means. But it also includes a clause that allows people to sue the government if they feel that they have been harmed. Anybody who resides or does business in Arizona may file a civil action for relief from any official action that violates this article. In other words, anybody who thinks they've been harmed by government use of a language other than English can actually sue the state for damages. You know, it's an open invitation to lawsuits. It's kind of a lawyer full employment act. And nobody is sure what that's really going to mean. I mean, does that mean, you know, if I'm standing in line at the DMV and I've got to wait an extra 10 minutes while they translate for the guy in front of me, can I sue the state for that 10 minutes of my time, you know, that I had to spend because they spoke Spanish to somebody? It also has a clause that allows people to sue the state if they think the state isn't enforcing this act.
Eric then spoke about Proposition 300.
On the one hand, we want to make it the official language and make everybody use it. On the other hand, we don't want to teach them how. And Proposition 300 actually was kind of an extension of an initiative that passed 2 years ago, which denied state benefits of many kinds to undocumented immigrants. This just extended that to several other things, not only in-state tuition and adult education and any kind of financial assistance. It specifically precludes child care assistance as well. And one of the really bad things about that is that the way they determine the eligibility for child care assistance is based on the mother. So the child might be a United States citizen, but if the mother isn't a citizen, she's not going to get child care assistance.
Eric then spoke about the effect of Proposition 102 and how it affects the ability for undocumented immigrants to file lawsuits.
It does not preclude undocumented immigrants from filing civil lawsuits. What it precludes is them from receiving punitive damages.
Okay.
They can still file a lawsuit and receive damage awards for actual damages inflicted. In other words, if someone is employed and their employer doesn't pay them, if they sue their employer, the most they can receive is the back wages that they weren't paid. The employer cannot be punished if this was an especially egregious action on the part of the employer. The employer cannot be punished by having to pay punitive damages.
I then asked Eric how all of these propositions had passed with an average of two-thirds of the state vote.
The public mood, unfortunately, undocumented immigrants are the boogeymen of 2006. And it comes down to fear of change in most cases. People are afraid of the changes that are happening in their world, and they want to do everything they can to try and keep things pleasant and familiar. Now, I doubt there's a lot of people down in Mexico who are going to be deciding, gee, I'm hungry, but if I go to Arizona, I'm not going to be able to get punitive damage awards, so I'm not going to cross the border to feed my family. They're not coming here because they want to vote in American elections, but, you know, we're scaring voters, do all these ID checks and everything to make sure that undocumented immigrants aren't voting in our elections. Well, you have to actually be a citizen to vote. You can't just be a green card holder. You've got to actually be a citizen. And by the way, all four of these, what I would characterize as anti-immigrant propositions, are ones that were put on the ballot by the state legislature. They were not initiatives where citizens went out and collected petition signatures or anything.
This is Molly Goss reporting with Voices in Exile for Informed Dissent. And next, we spoke to California State Senator Gil Cedillo about the Latino and Latino youth vote in the past November 7th elections, plus the Democratic takeback of Congress and some of the highly punitive propositions against undocumented immigrants that were passed in Arizona. So we're talking to State Senator Gil Cedillo. And the first thing I'd like to ask you, Senator, is about we just saw Arnold Schwarzenegger reelected as governor. What are the possibilities and what's your plan for the driver's license bill in the future, in the next few years?
Well, my plan is to reintroduce the proposal. It's the federal law. So my proposal is an effort for us to be in compliance with the federal law. We have a deadline of May 08, which means actually this is the year we have to complete it so that we can put the law into effect. And so my intention is to reintroduce it to the governor, and my expectation is for him to honor his word that he gave me when we worked to revoke the previous bill. My expectation is that he'll want California to be in compliance with the federal law, and my expectation is that in the context where hating immigrants is not as politically valuable as it was perceived, that hopefully he'll have the courage and demonstrate the leadership to do what's best for California.
Okay, and if we could turn to the national election for a moment, we saw that the Latino vote changed in a lot of regard and went to, you know, to make the Senate and the House in the power of the Democratic Party. What do you think? What do you think were the factors involved in that occurring?
Well, you know, there are very positive developments for the immigrant community. Obviously, the kind of almost unprecedented and clearly extraordinary attacks against the immigrant community, the efforts by extremists within the Republican Party to use them as fodder for their political agenda played a role. The introduction of H.R. 4487 was significant. The marches in the spring were significant. But frankly, I don't think the Latino vote has really scratched its full potential yet. It's only scratched the surface of its full potential, and I think that'll be realized when there's more of a commitment and an investment in the efforts to get Latino voters, or potential voters, registered and get them out to the polls.
Could you talk about in your district what efforts were made to get new citizens registered to vote and to get young people to vote?
Well, yeah, in our district, the efforts were, you know, frankly, rather modest. There hasn't been the type of large kind of, there's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of discussions about it, a lot of efforts working with various groups. But, you know, frankly, much of the leadership came from personalities like Kukui, the radio disc jockey, who went on a nationwide tour. Our office worked with him throughout the state of California, going out and trying to register voters. Other radio personalities spent a lot of time encouraging people to register and to vote. And so there were those efforts. There were some specific efforts through organized labor, a project called SOUL, which was focused on the immigrant voter, and they seemed to be very effective. And then there were some other specific efforts by the state Senate to register voters in target areas like the race in Orange County, the efforts to elect Lou Correa, which is still yet to be determined as the votes are being counted.
So do you think, like you said, it's still something that's somewhat untapped? Do you think in the next couple of years there's going to be...
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the young people are turning 18 in large numbers every year. The Latino population is much younger than the general population. But, you know, unfortunately, it's still, in voting, is not reflected in terms of what the demographics are. So Latinos participated maybe at 12% were some numbers that I saw. They should be, you know, at the 20s plus, and really they should be higher than that given the fact that they're, you know, some 30 to 40% of the state population.
What do you think some of the measures that could be taken to, especially to get the Latino youth vote out?
I think you have to, you know, talk to them. I think you need to have organizations and organizations that serve that community, the churches, the Catholic Church, but other churches also, unions. You need the educational system. We have a new Secretary of State who seems interested in franchising all Californians. And so particularly you have to talk to Latino youth about the importance of being registered. You have to facilitate that process, and then you have to you make a commitment to do the follow-up. I mean, it's really, you know, retail politics. It's really something that you have to spend time and resources. It's labor-intensive, but if you do it, then it's valuable for a democracy.
If we could just turn for a moment to Arizona. I don't know if you looked at the couple of propositions that passed in Arizona, for example, to deny bail to undocumented immigrants, denying civil lawsuit awards for undocumented immigrants. You know, a state where there is a significant Latino population, and these propositions passed by, there are four of them, they all passed by more than 70%. What do you think about that? Why do you think the people voted maybe first, second, third generation Latinos for those kind of really punitive measures and propositions? Or do you have a comment on those propositions? Have you looked into that?
They're unfortunate. They're mean-spirited.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely hostile to immigrants. And what they reflect is a lack of leadership. People blame immigrants and scapegoat immigrants for many of the ills of our country, same in California for our state. Mm-hmm. And in fact, immigrants are not the cause of other people's problems. They're not the cause of a diminishing middle class. They're not the cause of the lack of investment in our country's social and physical infrastructure. They're not the cause of job loss. They're not the cause of corporations, leaving our state and our country. But they get blamed for that, and they get blamed for that because leaders don't want to, be candid and honest about what are the causes of those problems. Mm-hmm. And leaders, for example, in our state, don't want to challenge those who have the most to be responsible and pay their fair share, particularly of taxes, so that we can have the types of social services and infrastructure that people expect, that people are accustomed to.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what people do is blame immigrants. And so when that takes place on a daily basis, on an hour-by-hour basis, 24/7, mm-hmm. it creates these myths, and people believe them, and people then begin to act consistent with those myths. And that's what those elections indicate.
And what do you think about a more accurate reading of history, or knowing our history better, just looking back in the last 200 years at different immigrant groups that have come and similar things have been done to them? How do you think we can educate, especially the youth, about these repeating cycles so we can stop repeating them?
Well, obviously if we can design it as part of our curriculum and part of our history, it would be very helpful for future generations. As I said, this period is extremely extraordinary. It's the type of hysteria that led to the deportation of U.S. citizens in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
The type of hysteria that leads to, for example, the incarceration of Japanese American citizens in the 40s, or the beating up of Mexican American youth. This hysteria is really extraordinary and unfortunate, although I have to say that, on the other hand, I expect it to change, given the fact that new leadership was elected, and we can have a new direction now.
And talking about that change, just looking at the national stage again, what do you think the possibility for immigration reform is with this new democratically controlled Congress?
I think there's a real opportunity to do something. I think something needs to be done within the next 6 months. I think it's significant that Harry Reid represents Nevada, that Las Vegas is one of the fastest growing cities in America. Las Vegas is growing and prospering in large part because of the work of the immigrant workforce. And so I look to his leadership. Obviously, Nancy Pelosi being from California, as the leader of the House, I look forward to her leadership on this issue. California has tremendously needs with respect to immigration reform. Senator Feinstein has played a big role in providing leadership on that with her efforts around the Ag Job proposal. Congressman Berman has also played a significant role in that. And so California needs immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look to both of them to provide leadership, and we're very fortunate that they happen to come from key states that are impacted by the role that immigrants play in our economy.
And what do you think, just the common man or woman on the street can do to try to move that immigration reform forward?
Well, I think they just need to bring it to the attention of their leadership, their mm-hmm. elected leadership, their council people, Congress people, their U.S. senators, their assembly persons, their mm-hmm. state senators. People need to be engaged and need to be asked to be responsible on this issue. This is mm-hmm. a very significant issue for us. Without immigrants, our economy would stagger. It would be uncertain that we could continue to compete in the global economy. We rely on the immigrant workforce to play a major role in our prosperity, and we need to do so in a way that is consistent with our heritage and with our commitment to human rights and human values.
And in your own as in position as a state senator, what are you going to do to continue to promote immigration reform at the federal level?
Well, you know, I think it helps to have legislation like the driver's license bill and legislation like my efforts to make sure that we don't discriminate against immigrants once they come into the university system. I will ask the governor again to work with me to create an Office of Immigrant Affairs. But for my personal role, I'll be working in a bipartisan effort with both our electeds here, but also working with people like Chris Cannon from Utah. You know, I've been asked to join a group with McCain, Senator McCain, a bipartisan group working with a chef in Los Angeles, Lee Baca. So I'll continue to do work. Also, I'll continue to do work with Mexican immigrants and Latino immigrants and the groups that represent them, because this is a binational and international situation that we have to be cognizant and sensitive to how this reform shapes up as it relates to the countries that send us immigrants.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Cedillo, for your time, and we wish you luck in your future endeavors in the months and years to come.
Thank you so much.
Voices in exile. Voices in exile usually consists of Molly Goss, Evelina Molina, Davin Cardenas, and yours truly. Who am I? Don't worry about it.